They help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up, refresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Hello, my name's Iris McPherson. I use they, them pronouns. I have a sociology degree from the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, and I grew up in Hawaii.
Cool. Thank you for joining us today. So what was your journey that led you to do this research on Hawaiian history, or I guess Hawaiian society?
Well, Hawaii's obviously always meant a lot to me because it's where I grew up. And it's given me a very, I feel, unique experience as a white person in this country in terms of not being surrounded by other white people. Mm-hmm. Like, I grew up knowing a handful of white kids in my school. And like the majority of residents were of Asian or Native Hawaiian descent or like any Pacific Island descent. So it was very unusual to see my face. And as a result, I actually have a hard time recognizing other white people because I just didn't grow up with their faces around me. So they all look very similar to me. I guess when I went away to college, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I spent my first year kind of flip-flopping, and then my junior year, I finally committed to a sociology major. And that also happened to be the year that the eruption at Leilani Estates in Pahoa on the Big Island happened. And it was this, just sort of this insane microcosm of disaster. But what made me want to study it and learn more about it was the way that people talked about it. People from the mainland, for example, would talk about it as a force of nature. Sorry for all my like throat clearing.
Okay.
Like people from the mainland would talk about it as a scientific process of an eruption, of a geologic concept. But people who I grew up with, people who even just have lived there for a long time, talked about it as a result of the goddess Pele, who is the goddess of volcanoes and fire. And she has a very important role, especially on the Big Island, because that's where she is believed to live, in the crater on the in the Volcanoes National Park. So she, part of what makes her so important is that she creates the islands. And when she erupts, it is a process of not destruction in per se, but a process of creation and rebirth and renewal. And that's exactly what happened in Leilani Estates. That was very interesting, is that she reshaped the island. She's very important because she can literally reshape the islands and destroy them or make new ones. And she's considered very temperamental, as I believe any goddess associated with fire should be. She demands a lot of respect, not just from Kanaka Maoli, which is the Hawaiian phrase for Native Hawaiian. Not just a lot of respect from Native Hawaiians, but also a lot of respect from the word is called transplant, for someone who has moved to Hawaii from another place, specifically, like usually the mainland, it's usually used for the white people who move there. but so she also demands a lot of respect from just all residents because we're living on her land. And so when I started to notice that difference, I was like, well, what is it about Hawaii that makes that conversation so different? What is it about the culture? What is it about the structure of how society works in Hawaii? What is it about the context of the history that influences everything? Because in sociology, we recognize that there are so many different things that influence people's lives, and history plays a really big part in that because it characterizes relationships between groups oftentimes. If there's a history in a town of racial segregation, you're still going to find that produced, I'm not going to say naturally, but like just reproduced in a way that feels natural, because that's how the history was set up. And that became the expectations for a lot of people in that community when it shouldn't be the expectation. Did I answer your question?
No, it's good because it gives a bit of context to Hawaii. And well, I was asking about like your journey that led you to this research into Hawaii sort of society and history. Will you be able to give a short summary of Hawaiian history to listeners just for a bit of context?
Yeah. So Hawaii is more than just a beautiful vacation destination. It is a chain of islands in the Pacific Ocean. There's actually hundreds of islands. There are only a few where like inhabitants live. I'm from the Big Island, which is actually called Hawaii, but that can get confusing. So we just call it the Big Island. Contact was established with white people. 1778, the Native Hawaiians met a white man who is now famous because his name's Captain Cook. And he eventually went too far with his interactions with the indigenous people, and they of course retaliated and killed him. And
what do you mean by he went too far? How did he first start to interact with the locals, the natives?
So it's a hilarious story, honestly. This man, Captain Cook, shows up, and he happens to show up during a time in the Native Hawaiian calendar that is considered a time of peace. And there are stories about how, like, oh, this god or person or just like kind of like cosmic figure is going to appear on a large boat with large white sails. And so a large boat with large white sails shows up with strange looking people that they've never seen before who speak a strange language that they don't understand. So they think, oh, like this has got to be like the guy, this has got to be him. But of course, they're also aware that he's a mortal being because, you know, gods don't specifically manifest. They're just kind of representative. So he shows up. It's a time of peace. They have this story about this big boat with white sails, and they're like, oh, this has got to be the guy. He needs some supplies. We'll give them some supplies and we'll have an interaction with them and we'll give him honors because right now he is considered this guy. So he leaves with his supplies and he's like, oh, I found these new islands. I found these new people. And then he runs into a storm that kind of decimates all of his supplies that he just got. So he's like, oh, well, these dumb native people that I met think that I'm a god, so if I show up again, they'll just give me more stuff. He shows up again. It's no longer the time of year that's considered peaceful. It's not a time of year that's more about like war and well, not specifically war, but it's a little bit more, I want to say, territorial. And so he shows up and he's like, I'm a god, remember me? And they're like, yeah, you were that guy who showed up. And he was like, yeah, give me supplies. And they're like, no, we're not going to give you supplies. No. And he's like, you're not going to give me supplies? Then I will kidnap your chief and kill him. Well, not really. Was it the chief or the chief's son? I'm not an expert. I think it was the chief's son, and he ended up being killed. And of course, the native people retaliated in a brief battle where Captain Cook was killed. His crew got out. They got out of Dodge, and they decided to go back to, I think, England, and be like, oh my God, they killed him and they ate him, which they did. They did eat him because in Hawaiian cosmology, the body is very connected to this energy called mana, which is similar to ki, in order to like compare it to another concept of energy. It's similar to ki in terms of like it flows through all living things. And they were like, well, this guy was a jerk, but he seems like he was a powerful guy. He seems like he was strong. So we will totally get some of that strength and some of that mana and energy by consuming some of his flesh. And that's just how it always worked. It was a way of immortalizing and passing on energy onto the people who are living from the person who died. And it didn't occur for everyone. Like, they didn't just, someone died and they ate the body. It was like a very specific sort of ceremony. And they hid his bones after the fact because, again, that was just part of how their burial worked. So my conclusion to that story is the indigenous people of Hawaii treated Captain Cook's body with more respect and reverence than he would have treated theirs. Mm. So that's the brief beginning. And of course, after one white person finds a new place, all the white people have to find the place. So Hawaii became this trading post in the middle of the ocean. It's honestly in a perfect spot for that. Literally in the middle of the ocean, this halfway point between Asia and America and South America, that also has access to the Indian Ocean, and it can get you, like, it's like a dream come true at this time when we don't have planes for trading. It's this halfway point where you can rest and restock and do all these things. That's great. However, there's this pesky problem for the traders of the indigenous people. So they established relationships with the Native Hawaiians. They established trade relationships. Native Hawaiians get goods from these traders. They get guns, for one thing. And then a child is born in Kailua Kona on the Big Island, where I'm from. And he goes on to become Kamehameha the Great, who unites all of the Hawaiian islands under one monarchy, which is very unique because up until that time, it was different sections of the island divided up by the different ali'i, which are chiefs. And so he establishes a monarchy. And this means establishing a sovereign nation with treaties and agreements between other sovereign nations. It means establishing a governmental structure. It means establishing laws. It means establishing a constitution and all that fun stuff. So Kamehameha the Great unites the Hawaiian Islands, and things are pretty chill for a while, I'd like to say. There's a lot of complicated things with foreigners, specifically missionaries, moving to Hawaii. And on the note of missionaries is that Native Hawaiians actually embraced Christianity because the things that Jesus was talking about in terms of loving your neighbor as yourself, doing unto others as you would have others do unto you, that whole concept was very in line with values that Hawaiians already had. So they were like, oh, like, I recognize what he's saying. I do this anyway. So in terms of conversion, it was, I don't want to say willing. they related to it probably a lot more than I think other Native people who were forced to assimilate did. Or they at least found things that they could value and recognize from their own culture. And obviously still people still revered the Hawaiian gods because the Hawaiian gods are very connected to the physical land of Hawaii. So you can't exactly separate that even after you've converted to Christianity. So Hawaii is a sovereign nation for generations. They have a monarchy, they have a house of lords, not house of lords, but like a house of nobles. And then in 1887, on July 6th, 1887, these Haole, which means foreigner, these Haole business owners seized strategic points of the capital city of Honolulu, and they forced the king at the time, who is King David Kalakaua, to sign into law a constitution that basically stripped the king of his executive power, that also stripped Native Hawaiians of a lot of their rights of specifically voting rights, because voting rights became based on property ownership. And these businessmen who made this constitution come into effect owned sugarcane businesses. And sugarcane requires a lot of land. So they already own property. However, the Native people do not own property in terms of Western ideas of property ownership, because the land doesn't belong to a person, the land belongs to the gods. And also because it was specifically structured to be difficult for Native people to register their land as their own. So that disenfranchises voters right off the bat. And Asian residents were absolutely not allowed to vote because they were just labeled alien. Because what's a hostile takeover of a government if you can't exclude everyone? basically, this constitution was a bunch of bullshit to bar non-white people from enacting change under this constitution that was forcibly signed into law by the king. So that happens. And everybody's upset because that sucks. What the hell, man? We're a sovereign nation. and the United States even said, what's going on over there? Like, why would you do that? And they were like, all these businessmen said, you have no jurisdiction over us because we weren't born in the United States. We were born in Hawaii. So therefore we're not really citizens. So you don't have power over us, which is again, a bunch of bullshit, because in the US Constitution, a natural born American, which is one of the requirements that let you run for president, which is ridiculous. A natural born American is someone who was either born on US soil or whose parents are United States citizens. So technically, all those white people were U.S. citizens. And so they should have listened to the government, but they made more money by not. And the government didn't really pursue it beyond that because they also kind of made money. Mm. So that happens. King David Kalakaua passes away. Rest in peace. So his sister and also his successor, his heir, Queen Liliuokalani, I love her name. I've always loved her name. I thought she had a really nice name ever since I was a kid. So she becomes the monarch. She becomes the queen. And she attempts to produce a new legal constitution that would replace this old one. And the old one that was put in place, that was forcibly put in place, is called the Bayonet Constitution because King David Kalakaua signed the constitution into law basically with a bayonet at his back. And so in this new constitution that the queen was trying to establish, it would have restored the executive power of the monarch, which would of course then go on to restore the political powers of the indigenous people of the islands. But white people can't allow that to happen, especially not when they're making a lot of money. So in response, on January 17th, 1893, the U.S. Minister of Foreign Affairs, John L. Stevens, who had the support of like a dozen, literally a dozen white settlers, as well as the U.S. Marines, forcibly overthrew Queen Liliuokalani. And that's insane, right? Like, she's the queen of an entirely separate nation, a small nation, but a nation that has alliances and treaties and trade agreements. So that crazy thing happens. And the United States government, like by urging of the people in Hawaii, starts to inquire. And their attempts to try to reestablish sovereignty in Hawaii were lackluster, because why would they try that hard to give sovereignty back to a nation of quote unquote savages? And the only reason they were considered savages was, of course, because they weren't white. So they inquired into what was going on. They ended up deciding that the actions of John L. Stevens was an act of war, and that the presiding government, which was called the Republic of Hawaii, that the presiding government was advised to step down. And when the Republic of Hawaii refused to step down, the U.S. government kind of just went, oh, okay, we tried, which is ridiculous. And just another symptom of American imperialism. So it becomes the Republic of Hawaii for a while. And then people start talking about it being annexed as a territory. And of course, Native Hawaiians aren't into that. They're like, no, we didn't even want any of this to begin with. Like, you decided you wanted this. So what happens then? Hawaii was never annexed by an official treaty, but by this strange domestic law called the Newlands Resolution, which basically was just a bullshit way to let the United States take land indiscriminately. And so, of course, there was widespread opposition from the people. two petitions were submitted to the Senate that were in protest of any annexation, and there were 38,000 signatures on both of those petitions at a time when only 40,000 Native Hawaiians, and this is including people who were racially mixed, lived in Hawaii. So you have the majority of people, the majority of Indigenous Hawaiians saying, no, 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 we don't want to be annexed, don't do that. And the Senate actually accepted these petitions. And they were like, okay, with this much opposition, it would be really impossible to secure the needed two-thirds majority for an annexation treaty. But then the president changed. And that changed everything for the outcome of Hawaii. Because the president before was like, yeah, let's not take over a sovereign country. And then he was no longer president. So our new president became, well, not, the United States president became William McKinley. And under his presidency, a lot of pro-annexationists lobbied for a joint Senate resolution where only a simple majority was needed in both houses of Congress to pass. So Hawaii was never annexed. So there's a lot of questions about the constitutional position of the annexation of Hawaii. So that happens. Hawaii is annexed, and for many years it is a territory. Then in 1959, there is a statehood vote. And what led to this vote were a bunch of stuff happening in the UN about territorial possessions. The statehood ballot, comes about because the UN has a fancy little thing called the United Nations List of Non-Self-Governing Territories. Hawaii was added to that list in 1946, which made Hawaii eligible for decolonization under international law. So this 1959 ballot happens, and it only has two options. And those options are incorporation into the Union, which means becoming a state, or remaining a colonial territory. So looking at what's happened earlier than 1959 in Hawaiian politics, we've had Native voters disenfranchised specifically for property ownership, like a forcible disenfranchisement. So a right to political self-determination is very important to them at this point. And the only way to get that with this ballot that they have in 1959 would be to become a state. Because as a state, you actually have a lot more rights. You get to elect your government officials. You get to have a word in Congress, in the Senate. So for that ballot, the best choice was to become a state. And then, months later, in 1960, the UN criteria changed, and it established another part of decolonization protocol. And if the ballot had waited just a few more months until 1960, it would have included additional choices such as free association and independence. So when this mischance happened, sovereign reclamation efforts became a little louder because it was like, hey, what the heck? If we just waited a couple months, we would have gotten to decide if we wanted to be independent again. We want to have that vote again, was a big point of contention at the time. But what was also happening when this vote happened was that Native people found themselves outnumbered by settlers as well as military personnel who were also allowed to participate in the vote since they were also residents of Hawaii. So all those people obviously voted to become a state because, you know, they're American citizens. They believe in the American ideas of basically manifest destiny and all that fun stuff. So Hawaii becomes the state. We get to establish a state legislature. We get to establish state laws. We get to participate in Congress and the Senate. But is Hawaii a state? Because it was never really legally a territory under the Constitution. So what a lot of sovereign, I'm going to say activists, a lot of sovereignty activists say is like this, like from the start, this wasn't legal. Nothing about this process followed the actual legal statutes set up by the United States or by international law. What the heck, bro, basically.
What is the education system in Hawaii? Does the syllabus follow the larger sort of American curriculum, or do you actually study this history?
We actually do study this history in depth. Well, not as in depth as my research revealed, but in a lot more depth than other schools in the union would. You kind of learn from day one about this forced takeover. So you kind of learn from day one about this forced takeover. You learn about the history of Hawaii. You learn about King David Kalakaua, who's also known as the Merry Monarch, because he brought back a lot of traditional Hawaiian dances, hula. So he was called the Merry Monarch because he loved having parties with the hula and seeing hula. So you learn about the fact that Hawaii was a sovereign nation, and that totally changes how you interact with the rest of that history. And of course you learn regular US history, which is its own very biased thing. And you know, with US history, my teachers didn't really go into depth about the various crimes that were committed. But when it came to history about the Hawaiian Islands, there was a lot more discussion about that. So children are very aware about the history that's happening around them. And they're very aware, especially Native children, are very aware about the disenfranchisement that their people have faced.
What is the dominant spoken language in Hawaii?
The dominant language is English. Okay. However, there have been a lot of efforts to reestablish Native Hawaiian language as something that's spoken by people. It's taught to kids. There are certain schools that were specifically actually founded by former monarchs for Native Hawaiian children to receive a quality education. And part of those schools is you speak, it's like you're in that school and you speak and you read and you write in Hawaiian, which is fascinating to me. And I also, in my elementary school, learned Hawaiian. I learned how to introduce myself. I have since forgotten it, but but I learned Hawaiian. And Hawaiian is actually also available as a language you can learn on Duolingo now.
Cool.
Yeah, that's really cool to us. So it was
there is like a one common native language, which is Hawaiian. There weren't like multiple. Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. I assumed that there obviously would be differences like island to island in terms of like, you know, slang.
Yeah.
But after Kamehameha the Great united the islands, that obviously meant a little bit of regulation to the language. And I wish I knew more about linguistics so that I could talk about the Hawaiian language for hours, because it's honestly very beautiful and very poetic. But this is not what that's about. That was not your question.
So, like that relationship the Hawaiians have with their land and with the gods, I think like from that sort of predominant Western narrative, that would be seen as just non-scientific superstitions and probably backwards. Yet on the other hand, I believe this mindset would bring about conflict with the local traditions, cultures, and beliefs. How does this opposition play out in Hawaiian society?
So when white people first showed up, they were like, who owns the land? And they were like, and the Hawaiians responded, the gods own the land, because they are the land. And our relationship to the land is to take care of it. And that made no sense to white people, because their relationship to land is about owning it and dominating it. So they were like, that doesn't make sense. You're going to follow our rules. So they were kind of forced to follow Western rules about the land. There have been efforts, particularly since, I want to say, the 70s, because the civil rights movement kicked off a lot of rights movements all across the country. Particularly since the 70s, there was this sort of resurgence in Hawaiian culture. Like, the language started being established again, the music was starting to be established again, the art and all of that was starting to be established again by the efforts of Native Hawaiians. So a lead off of that is when they're able to have the land that is their right to have, through this strange system of, oh gosh, okay, I have to explain this part first. So there's this really weird system in place in Hawaii where there is land that was formerly crown lands, which meant that they formerly belonged to the kings and the queens, that were released to be land for Native Hawaiians to own and work and sort of reestablish that agrarian relationship. And this land is currently held by a government office called the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. And there is a list for these plots of land that Native Hawaiians sit on for years before they're allowed to get the land. And like sometimes they sit on this list for generations. And there is a very, very specific requirement to be able to be on this list and have this land. You have to have a 50% blood quantum that is Native Hawaiian. And what that means is you literally have to be half Hawaiian at least in order to qualify as someone who is Native Hawaiian and who can get this land and have their rights as an indigenous person recognized. Obviously, that's impossible to do in a world that is so diverse, especially in Hawaii, that has so many interactions with different cultures and people. Interracial marriage was established as legal in Hawaii when it was a kingdom. So there's a value on that diversity in Hawaiian culture. There's a value in meeting new people and maybe even marrying them, falling in love with them. So that means that there's a value in being of multiple ethnic descents. So that ends up meaning that not a lot of people meet this criteria, especially today. Mm-hmm. When a lot of people are like, I'm Hawaiian, but they also have Filipino ancestry, as well as like Japanese ancestry, Korean, Chinese. So there's all this different stuff that interacts. And then when you're not 50% Hawaiian, you don't get to count. You are inherently placing value on something that doesn't exist. Blood quantum is made up. It's actually born from white supremacist ideas about racial purity. So that's fun. Not exactly. So it alienates you from your identity. Oftentimes it's just to build a house. Sometimes people get that land because they want to create a farm. Sometimes people get that land just to have a piece of nature, but that land is very hard to get. And of course, the flip side of that is that it's very easy for people moving to Hawaii to get their own land.
I think stories, fables, myths are important in human culture because that's what connects us as a society and also with nature. And actually, they hold a lot of teachings of a symbiotic relationship with nature that guides us in a positive and constructive manner that perhaps also attempts to tame the fallibilities of the human conditions such as greed or selfishness. But then it becomes increasingly difficult to convey the importance of such narratives in a world that sees anything that is non-scientific as less. This reductionist sort of attitude makes it very difficult for native cultures and traditions to thrive. I guess what I'm getting at is, how can we seed a different narrative? How can we introduce a different story that will allow us to understand the world from various perspectives and not a predominantly Western way of looking and understanding things? Because that's problematic.
I totally agree with you. So the question is, what can we do to diversify that narrative about what is and isn't legitimate explanations for how the world works? In terms of Hawaii, the way to look at it in terms of how Native Hawaiian culture has explained nature, fish and the other sea creatures, that happened naturally, but land animals like pigs had to be brought by Native Hawaiians. So there's this interaction between what was first there and what Hawaiians brought, and that creates an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And the really cool thing about Hawaiian stories in terms of their gods and the natural elements is that they're actually very accurate to how that land acts. So for the case of Leilani Estates, which had that eruption, it is a part of the island that has volcanic activity just written into its history. And you can learn about that volcanic activity through the stories of the indigenous people. So I suppose my answer to that would be recognizing that indigenous contexts for things are more than just a different way of explaining the natural processes of the world. They are documentation of how that world works and how that ecosystem works. Because just something that we've learned every time we meet a new indigenous group of people, something you always learn is that their relationship to the land is so much more knowledgeable. Like, for example, with the west coast of the mainland, how it's all on fire right now, and how scientists and people are finally starting to say, like, oh, maybe the key to lessening the severe effects of these fires is controlled burns. And that's something that the native peoples of the West Coast have been saying.
How are you for many people from all parts of the world? It's probably seen as this popular tourist destination to a large degree, and perhaps seen as exotic as well. And I think most tourists will go there expecting, you know, beautiful beaches, resorts, massages, hula. I guess it's almost like commodifying a culture. How is this seen by Hawaiians?
The tourist industry in Hawaii is very complicated. I personally would definitely say that, like, it's very, very much like commodifying a culture. The way that I've seen other Native Hawaiian, this, I don't want to say that what I'm saying is how all Hawaiians think about it, but some think about it as an opportunity to share their culture and their values, which is very important to Native Hawaiians, is spreading ideas that they have. And there are other people who are like, it's like you're dressing up to like kind of dance for people. There are people who feel that it's, I definitely feel that it's degrading. The thing about a tourist economy is that it's very unstable. When the pandemic hit, Hawaii had no tourists. And that's unfortunately how a lot of businesses get their business, is like by tourists buying stuff. And then you have no tourists, so no one's buying stuff. So that means that a lot of businesses end up having to close. I had a friend who recently went to visit the islands. And by recently, I mean months and months ago. And she asked me, like, okay, what's something I can do as a tourist to sort of reduce my impact? And I said, well, one thing you can do is buy things from local businesses, specifically businesses owned by Indigenous people. There's a lot of businesses owned by Indigenous people. And when you're interacting with the land, you know, sort of a leave nothing but footprints mindset. Mm. Pick up your litter, pick up any litter you see. Don't touch sea turtles. You are not supposed to touch sea turtles. They are endangered. Oh, don't be afraid to patron local restaurants. Even the greasy looking ones. Even the greasy looking ones. on the Big Island, there's this restaurant that's been there for years that everybody goes to. It's called Ken's House of Pancakes. It's a diner, but it's been there for generations for a lot of people.
Would you like Hawaii to gain independence?
If that's what Hawaii decides it wants, then I'm all for it. If Hawaii decides it wants to do a sort of free association situation, then I'm all for it.
Do you think Hawaii wants it?
I think that's complicated. With recently, there's been an uptick in discussions of sovereignty because of first the eruption in Leilani Estates, which displaced a bunch of people. Notably, a lot of them were Native Hawaiian. And also with the 30-meter telescope efforts, there's been a lot more discussion about sovereignty and what it means to be sovereign. Right now, I actually did a little bit of research before our meeting so that I could know a little bit more about this particular thing. Right now, a new political party was established in Hawaii called the Aloha Aina Party. So the Aloha Aina Party was specifically established in 2015, and it was established by three men I have their names because it's very important to properly credit people, especially when it's a party that's specifically concerned with Indigenous participation in local government. So it was founded by Donald Kaulia, Desmond Antoine Haumea, and Pua Ishibashi. And these three men, specifically two of them, are a part of an organization called the, I think it's the Royal Order of Kamehameha, which is big deal. They're kind of like, they're very respected, is the best way to put it. They're very respected, and their specific Indigenous sort of, the only word I can think of is fraternity, but they're not really a fraternity. It's like a, well, I can't explain it well enough, but it's it's an Indigenous people's organization. So those are the founders of the Aloha Aina Party, and they have a stance that's basically, they have five foundational principles. One is recognize the divine. So that relates to Hawaiian ideas about the land and how it belongs to the gods. And obviously they also say, worship your religion. Aloha Kanaka is the other one, which basically means to love and care for the people. And they say that doesn't just mean Indigenous Hawaiians, but it means all people, no matter their race, color, creed, or national origin. And I like this phrase that they use. Whether speaking of the homeless, healthcare, cost of living, housing, jobs, education, or quality of life, it's all about loving and caring for the people and doing what is in the best interest of the people. And those are the first two of their five principles. The next one is Malama Aina, which means kind of respect the land or care for the land. And they're like, we have to understand the symbiotic relationship that exists between people and the land, especially Indigenous Hawaiians. And we need to understand that the land has its own mana and spirit, and it has an intrinsic value beyond economic. And that sometimes land needs special attention and protection because of its sacred nature, like Mauna Kea. And their fourth principle, which I personally agree with a lot as well, is government accountability and transparency. They say, we believe in a government of the people and for the people. We believe government exists to serve the people. And as such, government has a fiduciary duty to act in the best interest of the people, to do all things with transparency, and to be accountable to the people for its acts and non-acts. Which is something I personally love because I think government should be more transparent and it should be held accountable for the things that it does.
Are these values a part of Hawaiian culture or a result of what Hawaii has been through?
It's a little bit of both, honestly, especially the ones talking about recognizing the divine in all the other things. And this last one, called, gonna sound funny, ponopono. And what it means is to make right what is wrong and restore that which was lost or taken. And they have an official statement. It says, it is the position of the Aloha Aina Party that we must ho'oponopono, which is make right or restore, the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1893. That for the good of all the people of Hawaii, this wrong must be made right. Which is isn't something that you often see in a political party in the US. And I don't know, I just find the Aloha Aina party really exciting because, you know, America has a lot of third parties. A lot of those third parties try to go on to the national stage. The Aloha Aina party is less about the national stage of politics, from what I've been able to understand, and more about getting people into local offices who care about their mission and their stance and care about what they're planning, what they're hoping to do. And they also endorse candidates too. So yeah, that's the most exciting thing for me that's going on right now in Hawaii, because I think it's such a comprehensive, straightforward response to some of the issues that Indigenous people find in Hawaii, because a lot of the issues result from not having a lot of representation in state politics, because there's a large population of Japanese, Chinese, Asian immigrants who came to Hawaii, so that ends up being represented a lot in the politics of the islands.
Is there a Hawaiian media, so content that's created by Hawaiians? I guess it can be for Hawaiians or not.
Oh yeah, there's definitely a lot of media out there that's been created. Children's books, actually. I grew up seeing in local bookstores a lot of children's books that talked about Native Hawaiian stories, or that talked about the land, or even just stories of like kids in Hawaii doing stuff. I remember there was one book that was about everybody coming to this grandma's house. The Hawaiian word for grandma's tutu. Coming to her house to have a party, and they all bring different foods. There's this really dope. It's kind of a language called pidgin.
Like the bird?
Kind of like the bird. I think it's spelled PIDGIN. And what that is it's actually technically a classification for language. But in Hawaii, it's just called pidgin. And what it is it actually combines Hawaiian words, English sentences, some Japanese words, maybe some Chinese words, Portuguese. And it has its own like sentence structure and vocabulary. And it's kind of hard to teach. The reason I bring it up is because one of the medias that we consider by Hawaiian people for Hawaiian people is this dictionary that's available of pidgin words.
What is the one thing that you wish people would take action or change in their lives? And this could be specific to Hawaiian context, but it could also be, you know, anything else that's on your mind. What would you say?
I guess right now, my biggest concern and my urging to people right now would be to vote. If you are an American citizen, make sure you are registered. Make sure that you're registered in the place where you are. Make sure that you can get your mail-in ballot before October. And vote in this election. Vote for your locals. Do research on who's running for your local offices, because the person who's put in charge of the local court system in your county is going to have a lot more effect on you than who becomes president. So vote for Joe Biden. That's my stance. He's not perfect. I don't like him. I would love for it to be a different person running, but we kind of need to vote for him in order to continue to have a country, basically, is what it feels like. Advice to people is vote. And if you live in Hawaii, do some research on the Aloha Aina Party. Check them out. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you for your time.
Hey everyone, thank you for listening. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play. Catch you next episode.